It's Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we bring you up to date on the Ukraine-Russia war. But first, last year was a record-breaking year for the lobbying industry. Businesses and interest groups spent $3.7 billion, more than any other year on record. And that was as lawmakers in Congress passed legislation to help the economy recover from the pandemic. And President Joe Biden tried, with mixed results, to pass his economic agenda. Now, reforms to the lobbying industry have fallen out of headlines in recent years. We want to talk about why and where those reform efforts stand today. And we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about the effects of lobbying on our government? Do you think it's important for businesses, unions, other groups to have a voice in politics? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page as well. Jim Thurber is our guest. He's a distinguished professor with American University's Department of Government. He's also the founder of the Public Affairs and Advocacy Institute at American University, where he teaches lobbying and ethics. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
First off, why do you think we saw so much spending on lobbying last year?
Well, lobbying usually goes up when there's a great deal of legislative activity and regulatory activity, which was going on last year. When we have a new president that came in and pushed through the COVID recovery bill, the infrastructure bill, and tried to push through Build Back Better, which had tax and spending provisions, everyone got focused and they started spending more money. The money came primarily from business, not reform groups, obviously. And it came from, you know, the big spender was the U.S. Chamber of Commerce with $66 million spent 1 year, and then the National Association of Realtors. But pharma and pharmaceutical companies, but also healthcare companies, were very involved because of a variety of issues like the pandemic and the regulations associated with vaccinations and masking and those things. They got involved. But Meta and Amazon and other high-tech IT companies were involved because they're getting pushback on privacy, pushback on buying smaller firms and becoming monopolies. So it was a active year. But to put it in perspective, the average amount of money being spent is about $3.5 billion. It shot up to $3.73 billion. Let me just say that this is just the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole lot of activity in Washington that most people would say is lobbying, but it's not covered under the Lobby Disclosure Act or the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And so I would double 3.7 as to the amount spent last year.
So what impact do you think this has on our government?
Well, we have First Amendment rights. We allow people to organize and petition government to lobby. And everybody can do it, but it leans towards organizations that have resources, money. It doesn't mean that money buys influence, but it certainly buys access. And so it brings forward problems and solutions in government that are leaning towards those who have enough money to tell people about it. And so it really alienates a whole lot of people because they think government is bought, sold, and rented by specialized interests. It isn't. It's competitive. And yet we need, I think, to have reforms that enforce existing law, but also bring more transparency to what's going on. The bottom line is democracy is very fragile, as we've seen this year with respect to Trump's accusation that the election was stolen in January 6th. And just part of that whole picture of people who are sort of alienated towards government because they think it's all specialized interests doing this. I think we need more transparency. I'm a reformer. We need more transparency and more enforcement of existing law with respect to lobbying.
So how do you think how do you think about the last administration where there was this call to you know, so-called drain the swamp, you know, speaking to people feeling that government had been corrupted? What impact has that had?
Well, drain the swamp came about in about 2005. It was an expression by Pelosi. Major reforms went through. I helped work on them in 2007, implemented in 2008. And it was stated by Obama, who was one of the reformers during while he was a senator, and then Trump pushed it also. He had a whole series of reforms that he proposed. None of them were implemented, and in fact, there was an open revolving door from specialized interests to run the agencies that were related to those industries. There are 88 lobbyists. That one day they were lobbyists, the next day they ran an agency. It became worse. The swamp had more creatures. They didn't drain it at all. Biden has been very quiet about that. He goes along with the reforms that Obama had, and he'd like to clean it up, but he has not made it as a primary focus of his administration. Too many other problems with the pandemic, the war, inflation, and a variety of other issues.
Sure. So with this, you know, as you mentioned, more money, big ticket legislation at stake, you know, attracts more interest, attracts more money into lobbying. I mean, can you pinpoint an exact impact, like a corrosive impact on our government by that increase in spending?
Well, that's a great question. Political scientists struggle with trying to define impact. I won't get into all the methodology of it, but let me say that I think the ultimate impact is that people don't trust government when they think that it's that big money buys access and influence. What big money does is it slows things down. It stops things. There are huge numbers of lobbyists against Build Back Better because it had to do with taxes as well as spending. And you don't see it, but it's there. And it's easy to stop things. It's very hard to push things. And so I think Americans see their problems in their lives, and they'd like to see some progress. And they see a Congress that's gridlocked, tied in the Senate, almost tied in the House, and with lobbyists having too much influence. And so I think that's bad for our democracy. The outcome of all of this is bad for our democracy. Now, on the other side, we need to have information and knowledge from those outside of government that are affected by the laws that are being considered. And so, therefore, we need lobbyists, but we need them, you know, environmentalists as well as pro-industry types. We need more competition among the various interests, and we don't have it sometimes. Sometimes it's quite lopsided, and certain areas are captured by certain industries, and they have the say, and others don't.
We're speaking with Jim Thurber, professor at American University, where he studies lobbying and political influence. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz, in for Rob Ferret. We're talking today about lobbying, its effect on our government, and efforts to reform the industry. We're speaking with Jim Thurber, professor at American University, and we want to hear your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. Should there be stricter rules to limit the power of lobbyists and special interests they represent? Give us a call or give us a comment on our Ideas Network Facebook page. So, Jim, this is your expertise. You study this impact. What do you think needs to be done with regard to lobbying to restore that faith and that trust in American government that you were talking about?
Well, I think the primary thing first and foremost is we don't need to pass new laws. We need to enforce the existing law of the Lobby Disclosure Act. There's lots of people in Washington who are lobbying who are not registered, therefore we don't know what they're doing. Now, it probably is okay what they're doing, but we need to know more about it. We need to have more transparency, and therefore we need to enforce and have people who are lobbying actually register. Secondly, we need better definitions in the Lobby Disclosure Act, which regulates the industry, about who they're lobbying, what they're lobbying on, and how much they're spending. It's pretty loose. And under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, for the first time in 50 years, we've had a couple of indictments and convictions of people lobbying for a foreign country without registering, which is the law since 1938, since we had Nazis lobbying to keep us out of the war. One of them was Manafort, who was lobbying for Ukraine and not lobbying, and there are others who were lobbying for Turkey and others, and we need to enforce that, have better definitions within the Foreign Agents Registration Act about lobbying. It's very broad. It's so broad that sometimes people ignore it. But once those indictments occurred, by the way, all of a sudden a whole bunch of people in Washington registered under the Foreign Agents Registration. It got their attention. And now we know more. Over 800 new people registered under this act, and we know more about it. I think that scandal drives reform, and we have scandal up on the Hill right now with respect to members trading stock. We have a thing called the Stock Act that regulates that. But a couple members in Georgia from the Senate lost their race to a certain extent. It was so close. You could point to this by buying and selling stock when they knew about the pandemic. They had information before other people about the pandemic. We need to stop that. We need to have, and this is a proposal that's moving, have everybody, senior staff as well as members in the House and the Senate, put their investments in a trust fund, because there's a huge conflict of interest there. That's part of lobbying also. But the main thing I would do, although I'm in the reform area and I have a whole list of things that should be done that probably won't be done, I would enforce existing law. By the way, there was a major proposal called H.R. 1 that's referred to the first bill out of the House this Congress and last Congress to bring about reforms on lobbying, but also reforms on the administration of elections to improve access to elections and ensure security, and also on redistricting, have commissions do it, have better oversight over ethics in the executive branch and other things. It passed overwhelmingly in the House, and the minority leader, Mitch McConnell, said, "We will not take up anything in H.R. 1. And since the Senate is tied, it's very easy to stop legislation. And so nothing has started. So the Democrats are associated with reform. Doesn't mean all of them are for it. And the Republicans seem to be dragging their feet with respect to reform for lobbying and ethics."
We're speaking with Jim Thurber from American University, and we do have a caller for you, Jim. Let's go to the phones. We've got Nate in Milwaukee joining us. Good afternoon.
Hi, thank you. I'll try to quickly run through a few points for you. First, that historically it was arguably activist conservative judges that kept stripping away some of the rules about money and politics over the years. Also, a number of referendums have passed, including in Wisconsin, that were for campaign finance reform, and including some specifically stating that money should not be treated as speech. And just because it came up, I would argue that Manafort was not advocating for Ukraine, but rather a corrupt, pro-Putin former Ukrainian politician, which is a noteworthy point because of current events.
So those are two good points. The second one I agree with. It actually was very technical. It was lobbying for a think tank that was associated with the past pro-Putin president. With respect to campaign finance, that's a whole area that needs reform. The Supreme Court allowed corporations and other organizations, unions, to use money as speech, and we don't know where the money is coming from into these super PACs. We don't know where it's going until 6 months after it's been done. It really has undermined transparency about campaign finance in elections, but it also undermines our trust in the whole system. I would reform that. Also, I agree with Nate, and thank you for calling.
And Jim, something you said earlier about Congress and lawmakers putting their investments in a trust fund, I'm very curious. We just have a few moments left, but I'm very curious how that would work in practice. Is there legislation currently to this effect?
There is legislation pending. It is not required now. I'm just advocating that they do it. Senator Ted Kennedy always put his portfolio in a blind trust. It can be done. It's easy. Carter, when he was president, put his investments in a blind trust. He actually sold his peanut farm so that there would not be a conflict of interest between what he was doing and peanut farmers in America. It's possible. And in fact, there's some bipartisan support for that reform. And as I started out with the hypothesis that scandal drives reform, well, there's been some scandal, a significant scandal about trades on inside information, not covered by the SEC, but on the Hill, and that both Democrats and Republicans would like to see that regulated. They differ on the details. And one of the proposals that seems to be moving, it is not law now, is to force everyone to have their investments in a blind trust.
So in the last minute we have, what are you watching most closely on Capitol Hill?
Well, right now I'm writing and watching about the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And it's niche, but I'm also looking at how Russia and China use our Foreign Agents Registration Act to throw pro-democracy groups out of their country. They use the actual language from our act to do that. I'm also looking at the implementation of the Lobby Disclosure Act. That's the major regulation over lobbyists in the United States. And I would like to see it spread to people who are obviously sure lobbying, like strategic advisors and sure coalition builders and social media sure people that are in these campaigns. We don't know how much money is being spent in those areas. It's not covered by the act. I'd like to see it covered by the act.
We will certainly follow up with you on that and keep us posted. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Jim Thurber, an expert on lobbying and special interests, political influence. He is a professor at American University. The COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated long-term college enrollment declines, as well as worker shortages in Wisconsin. As higher education and industry adapt, they're redefining the traditional pipeline from high school. Rich Kramer reports.
On a Friday afternoon, Random Lake High School's gymnasium is full of students moving through a sea of folding tables. More than 50 employers from industries like manufacturing, healthcare, and hospitality are there to talk about their post-graduation options. Dominic Montello is checking out employers. After making good money at a summer job, taking on debt for college doesn't sound that appealing.
I want to get right into the workforce, make money, as much money as I can.
Kelly Weibelhaus is manning a table for Career Foods, which manufactures popular soda and energy drink brands. She says the company is looking for students just like Dominic to go through the co-op course they developed with the high school. It offers paid, part-time work for seniors that can lead to a post-graduation job.
So why not put them in the workforce, see what they like, and then if they like that, have a company pay for their college.
Career Foods, like many companies, offers tuition reimbursement as part of its benefits package. The pandemic and low unemployment rates have added to long-term enrollment declines at two-year campuses in the state. Over the past decade, enrollment has fallen by 34% at state technical colleges and nearly 57% at two-year University of Wisconsin system campuses. Random Lake District Administrator Michael Trimberger is a co-founder of the nonprofit Inspire Sheboygan County, which acts as a bridge between businesses and regional high schools developing work-based curriculum. He says exposing kids to jobs before graduation makes more sense than having them choose a path while taking on student loan debt.
As we deconstruct the old narrative, the new narrative should be figure out what you want to do, explore what you want to do, and when you know, then skill yourself up through education and get to the level that you want to be able to really define what your success is.
Colleges and universities have long been partnering with high schools. The number of kids taking dual enrollment courses where students work toward associate's degrees has skyrocketed in recent years. At the same time, the percentage of high school grads, particularly young men, going straight to college is declining. Recent Plymouth High School graduate A.J. Klug says he felt lost near the end of his high school career. He thought about college but was deterred by the prospect of taking on lots of student loan debt. Instead, he signed up for an 80-hour co-op with local car dealership Van Horn Automotive and felt at home working alongside master mechanics.
And I got into the shop and I said to myself, this is actually something that I enjoy doing. You know, I found something. I don't have to, you know, worry about it so much anymore.
Klug is still working for the dealership and taking tech college classes toward a certification. Van Horn offered an apprenticeship program with $6,500 in scholarships for tools and tuition. Klug expects to finish his certificate without any debt. As businesses make inroads to high schools, the traditional pipeline from high school to college is changing. Wisconsin Technical College President Morna Foy says flexibility is more important than ever.
I think the career pathway, this idea that there are many entry and exit points, is really a reflection on the most significant change in higher ed. It is now being driven by what students and employers through their employees need.
Projections show the number of people hitting retirement age in many states will quickly outpace the number of working age adults. What's been dubbed the silver tsunami is likely to drive more high school recruitment by businesses and even greater changes for colleges. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we take a look at the latest developments in the war between Russia and Ukraine. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time, here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about some of the legacy of Title IX, a history still being written, as this weekend brings the culmination of the first officially branded March Madness Women's NCAA Basketball Tournament. But now, ongoing talks between Ukraine and Russia have resumed. Over the weekend, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine would be willing to consider becoming a neutral state in order to end the Russian invasion. Ukrainian neutrality is something Russian President Vladimir Putin has long pushed for. But at the same time, Zelensky has stressed that Ukraine must remain sovereign, and he's criticized the U.S. and other Western nations for not doing enough. We're talking about the latest developments in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join us here, 1-800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. needs to send more military supplies and weapons to Ukraine? Should the U.S. not get too involved in what's happening? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us, ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us here at Central Time WPR. We're speaking today with Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He specializes in post-communist politics. Lowell, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Molly. It's good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us today to break this down. Now, before we talk about the ceasefire talks, let's talk a little bit about where U.S.-Ukrainian relations stand. And Zelensky has criticized the U.S. and Western Europe for not doing enough. What does he want at this point in time?
That's a good question, because in some ways we continue to hear how pleased Ukrainian officials are with the amount of military support that has come specifically from the United States, and we're also working with them on sharing intelligence information and things like that as well. Obviously, they had talked quite a bit about pushing the West, U.S. and Western Europe and the rest of NATO to do a no-fly zone over Ukraine, although that talk has seemed to it been decreasing in the last few days at least, but they would still like much more in terms of support and getting that support as quickly as possible to them, because in some ways, because of their military successes, they're actually using up a lot of the equipment pretty quickly that we have been sending them.
And now, over the weekend, President Biden spoke in Poland. He made comments that the White House has since tried to walk back. Let's listen.
For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power.
So that was President Joe Biden speaking a little bit off the cuff there. Tell us what's happened since then, since he made that remark.
It's interesting because in the United States, a lot of people are just sort of saying there's a Biden being Biden moment, right, that he's known to do that. The problem with it is it does play into Putin's hands a bit in terms of giving him a PR kind of, talking point about the conflict that he has pitched to his own people, both with just a kind of complete fabrication about genocide looming for ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine, but also really trying to pitch it as about the West really trying to weaken and undermine Russian security. And so when President Biden does say something like that, again, that can be a little useful to Putin in making that claim. I will say it is not great form. I think in general, we don't typically talk about leaders being removed in advance of it happening as at least a U.S. policy. Although I would remind people, too, that his slip up a little earlier when he called, Putin a war criminal, and initially the White House sort of tried to backtrack that. A couple days later, that was official U.S. policy, right, that we're considering him that, and the State Department says that. So it'll be interesting to see whether they try to keep kind of walking it forward a bit in the next few days, or whether they do just hope that it gets dropped and forgotten about.
Saying the quiet part out loud, I feel like, is
right.
So tell us, with these ongoing peace talks, what has come of them so far today?
So two things to note. One you had mentioned earlier, which is the increasing emphasis from the Ukrainian side on the openness to a neutral status for Ukraine that would mean not official membership in NATO, but also not being a part of Russia, obviously, either. And that's a little more complicated in some ways, in that there's, as there is with a lot of things related to this conflict, there's a sort of second piece to the story. And it's that he has also said, as part of that neutrality understanding, that there would be security guarantees for Ukraine that would include the U.S. and Europe essentially guaranteeing that Ukrainian sovereignty would be protected, which in practice sounds very much like what would happen if they were a NATO member.
Right.
So it's kind of neutrality, but, right, I mean, there's that second piece that's going to be the sticking point, and Russia will not accept any idea of a kind of security guarantee from Europe to protect Ukraine in the future as part of a deal, I don't think, because that's been such a focus for Putin as the, one of the many justifications for this conflict is about NATO's encroachment through Eastern Europe and all the way, with Ukraine on the table as a future member. What Putin sees as coming, right up to the Ukrainian border even more than it already is with the Baltic states. So I think, again, the neutrality one is an interesting concept, and it is one that had been talked about briefly before the invasion. But again, in the case of Ukraine at this point, they aren't going to accept neutrality if Russia can just easily come in again with an invasion. The other interesting story kind of today is about the announcement from Russia that they are kind of pulling back a bit on activities around Kyiv and Chernihiv, which is a city in the far northern part of Ukraine. I think people are getting pretty excited about that in terms of thinking that might show that Russia is starting to back down. My take on that is actually that it is just acknowledging what has been happening on the ground, which is that Russia has been losing in the northern part of the country. They've lost territory to Ukraine around Kyiv, both to the east of Kyiv and to the west of Kyiv. So I think in some ways it's really just a kind of repositioning, regrouping strategy that may involve what they also said, which is they want to focus more on the far eastern part of the country and probably the southeastern part of the country rather than Kyiv. But again, that's as much as anything an acknowledgement, I think, that they just realized they were not going to be able to take Kyiv, maybe not even after weeks and weeks of fighting. They just might not be able to take it at all at this point.
So where does this leave the two sides in the conflict?
Well, again, I don't think we should expect it to end immediately. I mean, it's great that there are talks, that it is always good to have negotiations. You never know what's going to come out of them. So you always want to go through, even if it seems like you're going through the motions, you want to do that because it could be that some piece of something ends up, you know, working out as an agreement later. But the challenge for both Putin and Zelensky here is what is their outcome that they're okay with that overlaps with the other ones? And I just don't see where that is right now for either of them. Putin can't pull back all the way to kind of where they were before the invasion, I don't think. And at this point, Ukraine's actually talking about that's not even enough for them. They want Crimea and the eastern, you know, parts of Donetsk and Luhansk back as well. So I don't see a lot of overlap there. But again, we'll see down the road. If Russia continues to take more losses, there may be a point at which either Putin is pressured to or just decides that it is better to withdraw and then just use his massive, you know, propaganda machine back in Russia to try to spin it as a win.
We're speaking with Professor Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor at the Department of Political Science at Marquette University, and we have a call for you. We are going to go to the phones and speak with George in Ashland. Good afternoon, George.
Good afternoon. I had two parts to my questions. One I would call Quebec and the Donbass, another one I call Hong Kong and Sevastopol. So firstly, would it be helpful if the Ukrainians would focus more on healing the cultural divisions between the Russian-speaking and Ukrainian-speaking populations of some of their districts, heal that cultural divide? And it reminds me of the separatist movement of Quebec years ago, French-speaking culture versus English-speaking culture. So would that be helpful? The second question is, Hong Kong and Sevastopol, doesn't strike me that the Russian military will ever give up Sevastopol. So why can't the Ukrainians lease it to the Russians for like 500 years, kind of like the British leased Hong Kong from the Chinese, and therefore the Ukrainians don't give up their sovereignty, but they've made a deal that maybe works.
All right. Thanks for the call, George. Lowell.
So, George, those are both really interesting questions. I'm going to start with the second one. I think it's the quicker answer, which is that I would expect there would be some kind of agreement like that in any outcome that gives Ukraine territory back that Russia has seized. It's actually hard to imagine easily, at least, that Russia gives up Crimea, even if things continue to go really badly with the conflict. Crimea has actually been brought into the Russian political system as a republic within the Russian Federation. So that's a hard one to see. But if it were, I would agree that they would absolutely push for Sevastopol to be a military base with Russians there. And other countries around Russia have done that kind of agreement where they've allowed Russian troops to remain. So I think that does make some sense. The analogy with Quebec in the far east of Ukraine is an interesting one. I think one of the things that in my work and a lot of others who've done a lot of work with survey data in Ukraine the last few years have noticed is that the point that's raised about sort of finding a place for the Russian language is still important, and those are important talks to have. But one of the things we've been seeing is that line in Ukraine between the people who sort of look toward Russia as a place that they're feeling very connected and attached to and those who look to Europe, that line has moved eastward dramatically, and it did that after 2014. And it's continuing to do that so that in the surveys that we've done, one of the things we've seen is a lot fewer people who declare that they are ethnically Russian or say that they are Russian only speaking. And then, in fact, a lot of people are now saying they speak both languages or even saying they're kind of Russian and Ukrainian, not just Russian, in the eastern part of the country. So I think that's always going to be an issue about, you know, debates about street signs and what language they're in schools and what language that should be the language of instruction and things like that. And those talks will continue in eastern Ukraine. But again, I think that one of the things we have to acknowledge is, and one of the other people who work on general population attitudes in Ukraine put it, that Ukraine has become much more Ukrainian. And by that, he means the language has been taken up more in the east than it used to be. And there's a also pretty strong emerging sense of a kind of overarching Ukrainian civic national identity that had been forming, but again, sped up after 2014 and I think is really speeding up now, partly because, and it's one of the stranger parts of this conflict, that the areas that the Russian troops have attacked in some ways most forcefully have been in a lot of ways the most ethnically Russian or at least Russian-speaking parts of the country.
Right, right. Lowell Barrington is associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. We are speaking about Ukraine. What do you want to know about what's happening in Ukraine right now? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us, ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're speaking with Marquette University political scientist Lowell Barrington about what's happening in the Ukraine-Russia conflict. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-642-1234. And Lowell, I want to go to the phones right now. I want to speak with Marcus in Milwaukee with a question that, picking up on something you said earlier about potential for other alliances with Ukraine. Good afternoon, Marcus.
Hi. Hi, Professor Barrington. So my question, I guess that what I'm wondering is, why doesn't the U.S. look to perhaps like try and set up some sort of other system of alliance kind of similar to how we have NATO, except that it would consist of countries more like Norway, Sweden, and Finland, like that type of model, since the Russians already seem to be okay with them not being a part of NATO, but having some sort of mutual assistance pack, you know, if they were to be invaded, and see if we couldn't roll Ukraine into that so that it's kind of like a regional group with similar interests. So that way it can kind of sidestep the NATO issue. And it's also something that apparently the Russians seem to have been okay with thus far. So why not try and create some other, you know, North Atlantic Treaty Organization or something? I don't know what you call it, but
thanks, Marcus. Lowell.
That's a great question. I think part of the answer there is that there also has to be an incentive for those other countries. And if you are Finland and Sweden, for example, the idea that you would want to get into an agreement to guarantee that you would intervene against Russia if it attacked Ukraine again in the future seems to be something that it would be not necessarily in their interest to do, because they would potentially be drawn into a significant conflict that they, you know, may struggle with. So I like the idea. I think in practice, it's finding the incentives for the other countries. The second quick piece, though, is that there is at least a non-trivial chance that both Finland and Sweden will be NATO members down the road. I think that on the long list of things that Putin's invasion of Ukraine has done has really made it obvious to Europe how important and relevant NATO is. And I think it is, I mean, in both countries it's being talked about, I think it's quite likely that they will pursue NATO membership actually in Finland and Sweden. And I think that at this point in time, at least, there's no reason to think of Ukraine being able to join NATO anytime soon, just because they have been so destabilized and the invasion has done one thing for Putin, which is to show that he can, in fact, destabilize Ukraine if they were to ever, you know, think about getting serious again about a NATO membership.
Which arguably was the goal, one of the goals.
Right. And that way he's won. Right. He won in taking NATO membership for Ukraine off the table. That is not going to be anything that's going to happen in the near future. On the other hand, again, there is the tally sheet. You know, that's one of his only wins. Right. And then there's this huge number of things that have been really important losses for him in this that I don't think, you know, he's happy with the way that the balance on the two sides of that tally sheet go.
Yeah. I want to go back to the phones. We have a caller, Gary, in Madison with a question about refugees and the visa process. Good afternoon, Gary.
Good afternoon. My question is about the 100,000 visas that President Biden has announced that he's going to make available to Ukrainian refugees. But if you go to the State Department website, number one, the embassy in Kiev is closed. Number two, you can't apply for a refugee or that visa in the embassy in Warsaw. You have to go to Frankfurt, Germany to apply for those visas. So my question is the administration really sincere about this, or is this just public relations posturing?
So, Gary, I think that they are sincere. Some of those details may be able to get worked out down the road. It may be that we could end up doing this in Poland instead of Germany. But there are so many refugees right now that, in fact, a large number of them will end up making their way to Germany. There's actually reports of Ukrainian refugees showing up at the southern border in Mexico and requesting to become part of that process already. So, you know, that's another way we might think about it. They may find other ways to try to get closer to the United States. But in the meantime, again, Germany is also bracing for the number of refugees that have gone into Poland, for example. They can't all stay in Poland. Poland can't handle that many people, and even in some ways Hungary and Romania are looking to send some of those refugees farther west. So I think the part of the process of being an alliance is, yes, we have to take seriously the idea that we are going to accept refugees, that if we don't do that and we get a refugee crisis in Europe, that's one of the ways that this really impressive unity that's been developed between the United States and Western Europe could start breaking down, as if there's just a massive refugee humanitarian crisis and we're not playing a role to help that.
Mm-hmm. Good question. When we've got calls are pouring in, I want to take next Mike from Waukesha. Good afternoon.
Hi,
Mike.
Hello, good afternoon. So, social media, there's a buzz going around, and there's these foolish questions, I think. It asks, you know, would this have happened under President Trump's watch? And in fact, I think President Trump partially caused this, because when he tried to back us away from NATO, this emboldened Putin. The other thing is I think it was going to happen anyway. There probably would have been less bloodshed, but then either way, then Russia would have tried to get what it wanted. I just wonder what your guest comments are. Thank you.
Thanks. Lowell.
Well, Mike, I agree with you to an extent in that I think one of the things that Putin saw going into this was at least he believed that Europe and the United States would not be united in a response. And that was partly because of how bad relations had become between the United States and Europe leading up to 2020. But at the same time, I also want to say that the timing also relates to the idea that since President Biden has been in office, that there was renewed talk of Ukraine becoming a NATO member. So I don't want to say it's only a problem prior to the administration. I shouldn't say problem, but it's not just a cause of the bad relations in the past. It's a combination of the fact that Putin believed that Europe would be would not be able to be united. And you know, and again, if we think about, if I told people before the war that, you know, we're going to help figure out how to bring Germany, France, and the UK together along with us to bring all these countries together, and on top of that, you know, Switzerland is going to impose economic sanctions. I mean, just the number of things that have been able to happen in the united response have been really impressive. But again, that took a lot of work, because where Mike is right is that there was significant damage done to our relations with Europe in the previous administration. And I think that we need to acknowledge the Biden administration has done a very effective job at putting together this this alliance right now in terms of its economic responses and military support for Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Unprecedented. Well, Lowell, we're almost out of time, but I would love to hear what you are watching for out of these peace talks.
I don't think I'm very optimistic about them, I guess is what I would say. They're important. Again, I think they should be happening, and anytime you get sides together, it's a good thing. But the real question again is, what are the off ramps that Putin could find acceptable that Zelensky also can accept and would be politically possible in Ukraine? And that's the really tricky part here, is that Zelensky has done this amazing job of rallying the Ukrainian people, but he's done it by the idea that we're not going to surrender an inch of this territory. And so for him now to take that step toward a deal that might involve, in fact, acknowledging that Russia is going to control territory in Ukraine, that's going to be very difficult for him to do. But for Putin, there's no real incentive for him to withdraw, even with the losses they're taking, unless there's something he can point to as a territorial or some kind of situation that was better than it was when the invasion started. So I think that's one thing to look for, is just, are there any opportunities where you see something that kind of overlaps between the two positions? The only other thing to keep an eye on is whether we start seeing cracks within the Russian government and you start seeing more criticism or more acknowledgement of the number of losses. But I think it's a slightly conservative estimate, but there are likely at least 15,000 Russian troops that have been killed so far in a month in this conflict. That is, you know, 500 a day. It's an incredible number of losses. And that, along with the economic problems, will certainly put at least some pressure on Putin going forward.
Well, Lowell Barrington, we will be watching. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Molly.
We've been speaking with Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Lee Rayburn talks talks to the investigative journalist and filmmakers behind the new Frontline documentary. It's called Plot to Overturn the Election. That's coming up tomorrow morning on The Morning Show at 7. And now for a little bit of different March Madness news. States across the country are recruiting volunteer weather observers. There's this group called COCORAS. It stands for Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network. It's a grassroots network of weather observers of all ages. These volunteers, they measure rain, hail, snow in their backyards and report it in real time. The National Weather Service, then they use this crowdsourced data to inform their weather forecasts alongside other modeling. How cool is that? And I've got to tell you, there's this friendly rivalry going on right now between Wisconsin and Minnesota as to who has the most weather watchers. I just checked today. Minnesota's in the lead with 356 volunteers, but Wisconsin's in second place. The group, it's called COCORAS.